This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indivisible Northwest Indiana is a community activist organization which has been involved in a lot of activities, some going on various topics and causes, and some of dealing, of course, with getting people registered to vote and the like through the election process. And we're going to find out what the group has been doing these days, and in particular, what's coming up, particularly as we go into the summer months. Kim Eldridge is the president of Indivisible Northwest Indiana. Kim, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, for folks who are not necessarily familiar with the organization, tell us about how the local group got started and the origins of the big national group, because it is part of a big national organization.
Yes, definitely. Well, I can tell you that right after the current president was elected, there were several staffers who had worked in Washington, staffers that had worked for congressional members and members of the Senate, and they got together and they wrote this guide, and they called it the Indivisible Guide. Basically, what the guide was all about was a way to tell the average person how to contact and talk to their member of Congress or the Senate. It told people what the senators or congressmen actually listen to, what they don't, how you can approach them in a manner and will they will pay attention to you or the issues that you want to speak to them with. It was just really an indispensable guide from someone who actually worked for those people in Washington to tell us, like, what to do, how to get through to them. You know, if causes we really believe in, how to approach that member of Congress. And they also felt it was very important because they felt that the person that had just been elected president was somebody who went against every single value that these people had.
Mm-hmm.
They put this out online. They put this out on the internet. People started reading it. It took off like wildfire. And what people started to do was to make their own groups and call them Indivisible. You know, and we were started immediately after. The person's name is Jessica Hogg, and she started the organization Indivisible Northwest Indiana that would cover Lake, Porter, LaPorte, Newton, you know, anybody in Northwest Indiana who wanted to be a part.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how it started. Now there is a chapter of Indivisible in almost every county in the United States.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing.
I recall that one of the organizations set up an outdoor campaign or a rally of sorts, I suppose. It was a rather chilly day in the park in Highland, Indiana, and I know that Indivisible Northwest Indiana was a part of that or that particular event. In fact, even it started to rain too, but that didn't deter anybody from showing up or staying out there and speaking out and showing your concerns about the causes and the like. What areas in particular does Indivisible Northwest Indiana want to focus on or has been focusing on these days?
Well, I will tell you one of the big issues that we focus on is voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
We all feel like it's of the utmost importance. We know that in the last presidential election, there were so many people who did not vote. So many people who aren't even registered to vote. So we felt that, you know, this is something we could take up and do it all the time. Whenever voter registration is open, we contact organizations, we contact schools, I mean, the list goes on, and we set up voter registration days. We found that it's really effective, not only to register people to vote, but we also talk to people about being civically active. Now, I will say this, we are a progressive, left-leaning organization.
Right.
Okay? We are open to talking to anyone and having anyone come to our meetings as they are public. But when we do voter registration, it has to be nonpartisan. You cannot do voter registration in a partisan manner. So when we go out and do voter registration, we merely talk to people about being civically active. We get them registered, and we also look up their polling places. and give them the address of the place where they need to go vote, because we think that's terribly important. We also get involved in causes we believe in, and that would be the current crisis at our border. We have had speakers who have come and talked to our group, and also, like I said, our meetings are open to the public. These speakers have talked to us about what's going on in the border. That's something we're all very involved in. There's so many topics. Gerrymandering, this is something we're really looking at and trying to figure out, you know, by each state, how can we help to combat gerrymandering? Our last meeting was about women's reproductive rights and Planned Parenthood, which was a great meeting, well attended, and we heard from Planned Parenthood as to what they actually do. We wanted to educate the public on what Planned Parenthood actually does versus what a lot of the media says. So those are just some of the issues. We're involved in almost everything.
On the subject of voter registration, since that's one of the key issues that really got the group started, I understand, we, of course, had changes here in Lake County in particular that have been mandated by the state, and the changes have included fewer precincts in some communities. Has it been more difficult during this, in particular, the primary election cycle, and maybe what we have to face in November for the general election coming up, in making sure that folks that were in areas like Gary and East Chicago and Hammond and other communities that have had fewer precincts now because of the changes, to be sure that they're let them know that they've got to get out, be sure to register to vote when they can get out to vote?
Yes, that's of the utmost importance. I mean, of course, we were saddened to learn that this was happening. But, you know, it's one of those things, we can't sit around and be sad. When we learn something like this happens, we have to move into action. And so we definitely get out there and get into communities like Gary, East Chicago, Hammond, the list goes on. We definitely are going to be talking to people about making sure they know where they are supposed to vote, making sure that they're registered. But the biggest thing is, if you're registered and you think you're going one place and you really need to go another, that's not helpful. So, you know, one of the things that we make sure we do is, you know, we give people information. We're not there just to register you to vote. We're there to answer questions if you have them, to talk to you and tell you where you need to go to get the right information and to make sure you know the right place for you to go and actually, you know, cast your vote.
Mm-hmm. On a related topic here, we know that they've had problems with the elections in Porter County. It turned out that they made some changes, some big changes, as a matter of fact. In fact, yeah. They have a state law now, or will become a state law, on helping make more changes possible and make them more permanent. How did things come out as far as you folks are concerned with how this primary election that were held in Porter County come out? And do you see that these problems are maybe gone for good, or at least they certainly are worth changing more?
No, I think that what has taken place as far as changes has been terrific. I myself was a judge in this last election. Mm-hmm. In Porter County, because that's where I live. And I saw firsthand that things went off extremely well, extremely well. And most people I talked to in Porter County thought the same. You know, there's always one or two hiccups. It's just the way it is when you are depending on people to show up and what have you. But I will say this, I think it was a total turnaround. It went smoothly. People seemed to be happy. Information was given out beforehand, and also there were several meetings for all of us who actually were involved, you know, in going in and being at polling places that, you know, probably hadn't happened before. To me, it was as good as it could get. So I think that the changes are permanent.
We're talking with Kim Eldridge. She is the president of Indivisible Northwest Indiana, which is a Northwest Indiana branch, so to speak, of the larger nationwide Indivisible group. And we've talked here about the, some of the main issues that, that the group's gotten started in as far as making sure that people are registered to vote and get out to the polls to vote when they can, and be able to have an opportunity to listen to the issues and the like. And you've mentioned some of the issues that have been discussed so far, including immigration and problems as well, too, with other issues here in our country. On the subject of immigration, what kinds of support have you gotten or are you giving to other organizations that are fighting the issues of immigration here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, for instance, maybe it was a couple months ago that we had a meeting that was focused, a public meeting focused on immigration and getting information out to people.
Mm-hmm.
We had several speakers, Ruth Needleman, who is with NWI Resist, which is another organization that really gets out there and helps as far as getting information out to people about the whole immigration crisis. And she was fantastic. She's a professor emeritus with IUN, and she actually talked about what happens to people during the deportation process. You know, how things process through the legislature. I mean, she just gave lots of information. She talked about the fact that people are now deported out of O'Hare versus so much in Gary.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to take them to O'Hare where, you know, there isn't as much chance of people actually seeing what's going on, to be honest. We also had Alfredo Estrada, who is a partner with BCC Legal. He actually represents people who are here trying to go through the process. And, you know, he gave a fantastic overview of, you know, things that he has worked with, you know, stories that he had about working with people and representing people. He did let us know, though, that, you know, I think the average person doesn't know how expensive it is for a person to go through the process to become legal and how many years it takes. You know, for instance, you know, $5,000, that is a lot for an average person to come up with to pay to start the process.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he's been invaluable in coming to us several times to give us, you know, more information so we just understand that the process isn't as easy as some people think that it is, you know, and issues that people have trying to actually really get through the process. Right now, a person that he's working with has a court date of 2022 because that's how backed up the system is.
Good grief. That's a real backup, to be sure, here, and especially here in the Midwest. It's going to be very difficult to get many of these cases heard, and I'm sure that they're probably, the residents are probably very concerned that ICE and other organizations with the government are going to take action before some of these hearings actually take place.
Well, yes, and there's plenty of people who are in the process. They're going through the process. You know, they've gotten money together, and they are starting or in the middle of the process, but the process takes years. And in the meantime, people are being picked up who have already paid their money and have already started the process. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, we think that's unfair.
Now, you've had this one recent discussion about immigration. Are there more that are going to be planned by Indivisible Northwest Indiana in the future?
Oh, definitely. This is an issue that isn't going away anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that demands action. So what I want to let you and listeners know is that we actually have a great Facebook page, right? And we constantly are posting about what's going on with these issues. And we also post about what we're doing, what we're getting involved in. And, you know, we definitely like to partner with other organizations too and let them know that we are available to help when they get involved in these issues. You know, we have lots of members, and, you know, people get really passionate about different issues, and, you know, we definitely tell them, hey, you know, reach out to other organizations too, get involved, tell us about it so that we can get involved too.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask one last question here, and this is back to a topic that you mentioned earlier about the redistricting reform issue. We know that the U.S. Supreme Court, of course, handed down a decision here that is concerning to many people still, which maybe, I guess, in a way, may break down some of the barriers that have already been put up to redistricting reform. Even Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana, who's not happy with how the decision turned out, said well, they don't have one excuse that they can use to put up to make things keep delayed the matter. So do you think that's the case, that they're, that even though it's not exactly the way that everybody wanted it turned out, that it's going to kind of help push the issue of redistricting reform, especially to the General Assembly, that much faster?
Yes. Of course, we were all super disappointed when we heard what the Supreme Court had to say. And, of course, they say they don't want to get involved in politics. We think that it's an even bigger issue than that. It goes to fairness. There's a million other things that are involved with this that, you know, they didn't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But now that it's happened, it is what it is. We try to tell people when things like this happen, it's not like you just say, well, oh, well, this is the way it is. No. Now we take it to the states. Everybody in each in their own state has to keep this on the forefront. We have to make sure that the General Assembly is aware of the fact that we don't like this. We want reform in this area.
Well, Kim, thanks for spending time with us to talk about these issues that Indivisible Northwest Indiana is very much involved with and concerned about. And we'll keep an eye on the Facebook page to find out what is discussed at the time, as well as any future meetings coming up. Thank you for being with us to talk today.
If you go to Facebook, we're at Indivisible Northwest Indiana. And online, we're indivisiblenwi.org.
Kim Eldridge is the president of Indivisible Northwest Indiana. Two Indiana University students are spending the summer in Gary and in Michigan City, collecting data that can be used to create programs to reduce greenhouse gases, gases that affect both the local environment and the city's economics. Janet McCabe with the IU Environmental Resilience Institute was originally speaking to talk about the first program to create greenhouse gas inventories that will benefit the communities.
We know from a lot of research that's being done here and elsewhere that our climate is changing and that we need to get a handle on the greenhouse gases that are being emitted that are helping to cook the planet. So this program allows these cities to inventory, basically to get an understanding of what greenhouse gases are being emitted in their cities, in their communities, and also, if they wish, within state government itself. And if you know the old saying, you can't manage what you don't measure, until we have a sense of where the greenhouse gases are coming from, it's really hard to design programs that will help us reduce and mitigate those emissions.
I know we take a look at the greenhouse gas emissions on the literally the global basis, or that we talk about beyond just the community basis here, but there is something that we should know about, I guess. As you mentioned, the inventory is going to help keep track of, because there are problems that happen here at home, not only with climate change and other things, too, that do come down to not knowing where the greenhouse gases are coming out and the impact that they're having, aren't they?
There are just so many things to know about keeping track of this. So one thing we do know is that every ton of additional carbon that goes into the atmosphere is going to increase the effects that global warming and climate change is going to have on our communities. And that means hotter temperatures. It means more rain when we don't need it and less rain when we do need it. And just as an interesting little statistic, in Lake County, if now people are used to having just a couple of days a year, really, really hot days, like over 95 degrees. By the middle of this century, Lake County can expect to have a month's worth of days over 95 degrees. So just think about the impacts that will have on people in their daily lives. Do they have air conditioning or do they not have air conditioning? How much time do they spend outside? What does it mean for landscaping? What does it mean for infrastructure? All these sorts of things that, what does it mean for mosquitoes and allergens and that sort of thing? So this, we're talking about real impacts on people's communities. So we want to do the best we can to reduce those emissions. But there are other advantages too, because if a mayor finds out through doing this inventory that he or she is spending a lot on old, perhaps energy inefficient heating and cooling systems, which are one of our biggest sources of greenhouse gas emissions, that mayor would then have some support to look at designing a program to upgrade, invest in more energy efficiency, which not only reduces greenhouse gases, it reduces other air pollution, and it also saves the taxpayer money. It's win-win all around.
Well, taking a look at our communities here in Gary and Michigan City in particular, how do they get involved in getting on the list, so to speak, so that they're one of the communities that are getting involved in this first resilience cohort?
Yeah, good question. And I want to give a shout out to both of those communities for stepping up for this first opportunity. So the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute, which you mentioned, which is one of the university's grand challenge initiatives, is supported working with our IU Sustainability Office, supported by the McKinney Family Foundation, to provide a summer intern to each of a bunch of cities who want to do this. This is the first time that we're doing this. It's basically no cost to the cities. They get a trained intern from IU, either an undergrad or a graduate student, to spend 10 weeks working on this. And we at the Institute worked out a relationship with an organization that provides software and training for cities that want to do these inventories. So there's a very well-developed protocol that people can learn how to do to collect the information that you need and put it in the right format. We've got 13 cities all across the state, all the way from Evansville in the south to Gary and Michigan City and Goshen in the north, big cities, small cities. We have Oldenburg, Indiana, which has 600 people and is the smallest city ever to do one of these inventories. So we knew that Michigan City and Gary were both cities that are being very proactive when it comes to sustainability and resilience work. And when we put out the solicitation, anybody want to do this, they stepped right up right away.
Brenda Scott Henry is involved with the city of Gary's Green Urbanism Department, and I'm not surprised that she would be to be the first on the list to be sure that the city of Gary got a chance to get some help in looking into the issues of greenhouse gas emissions. When it comes down to actually measuring around the community to see where these gases seem to be collecting, at least where the spots that seem to be the most prevalent for these, is it something similar than what the Indiana Department of Environmental Management certainly has done for years up here in the region and in dealing with the pollution problems?
It's not unrelated. So the Department of Environmental Management has programs that collect pollution information from industry, from large industrial operations in Lake County, actually all across the state. And those sources, like the steel mills and the power plants and the refineries and all, have to report their emissions of air pollution. There's no requirement in the same way for reporting emissions of greenhouse gases. There is a little bit, actually, but not at the level that would give you a sense of what's happening in the community. So a lot of our greenhouse gas emissions come from our use of power and heating and cooling and electricity needs. A lot of it comes from transportation. So it's about a third comes from power use, about a third comes from transportation. And the way you get a sense of emissions coming from transportation is kind of what NDOT does, working with the Department of Environmental Management to look at the vehicle fleet and the miles traveled and make some estimates about where those emissions are coming from. Michigan City and Gary are very proactive cities, so I know that they will be eager to have this information so that they can then start putting together a resilience plan that will include specific actions that will be prioritized based on the information that they collected.
The Environmental Resilience Institute is part of the Indiana University School of Environmental and Public Affairs. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. There are a number of new names or maybe even some new faces showing up in the politics here in Northwest Indiana and in Lake County in particular in the last election. And a lot of these young people, and some are old people, but many are young people who are interested in getting involved in public office. We'll find out more about this new crop of candidates who are going to be up on the ballot for the November general election. Jim Weiser is the Lake County Democratic Party chairman, and he joins us. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Looking forward to it.
Now, I understand this is all of, I guess, the effort that the Lake County Democratic Party has been making in recent months to try to recruit new candidates to be on public office. Is there any reason, obviously, just to maybe just have more people on the ballot, that we're finding more people that are coming in interested in running for public office?
Well, I think, Chris, it's a combination of a couple of things. We made a concerted effort in 2018, first of all, to start out with our organization and try to encourage younger people to get involved by becoming possibly precinct committeemen or vice committeemen. and getting involved with the party. So that's kind of where it began. And then we started also to try to recruit candidates. And we discovered that in 2018 there seemed to be a lot of interest. I'm sure it's sparked by what's occurring nationally, a lot of interest. And we ended up just by our recruiting efforts and by networking, getting candidates to run for office like younger, like you said, there's younger people, there's new faces. That we got Chris Chung, who ran in the 15th district and beat an incumbent that folks said couldn't be beat when he beat Hal Slager. We recruited Lisa Beck, who's done an outstanding job as a legislator who won her district over Julie Olthoff. We recruited Reagan Hatcher to run for state representative. Of course, Eddie Melton has been there for a while, but it was an effort to get people more engaged and younger people and new people committed to the Democratic ideals and principles. And it's so far as you can tell, it's been working really well.
Go through the list of communities that you and your colleagues with the Lake County Democratic Party have been asking people to become members of the electorate and in turn becoming public officials if they get elected. Go through the communities to tell us about some of the people that have decided to get on the ballot in the cities and towns around the area.
Sure, I'm happy to do that, Chris. I'll kind of start on the northwest side and work my way east.
Okay.
In Hammond, you may note that two new folks, Barry Tyler and Katrina Alexander, both won primaries over long-term incumbents and did it by grassroots, I mean, totally grassroots organizations. Both of them are very young people, both of them very engaged in their community. They're going to be, I think, great additions to the Hammond City Council. In Gary, for example, we have two more people, Ty Atkins, a young lady who ran. Now, that was an open seat because Carolyn Rogers didn't run for re-election in the 4th District. But there were, my recollection is, five or six candidates, and Ty came out successful. Young lady, 32 years old, Gary Westside graduate. I played college basketball. She's just a very smart, dynamic young lady. Then Bill Godwin, who won in the 1st District in Gary, another bright young face. Then over in Lake Station, Bill Carroll, who won for the primary for mayor, again, another open seat, is a young man, young businessman, and was recruited because he was just interested in his community. He owns a business in the community. It's successful. He wants to keep it that way, and he wants to do what's well. Then kind of moving back over in Munster, we recruited a young lady who's running for clerk treasurer, and her name's Jennifer Pizzuto Dean. And she's a very bright young lady, a Munster resident virtually her whole life, and again, someone who wanted to get active and got very involved in having talked to her numerous times, very involved in national concerns about national politics. She wanted to translate it into local, have a local impact. In Highland, we just caucused in to replace Dan Vassar, who decided after a very successful term as a councilman that he wanted to spend more time with his family and pursue other interests. We caucused in a young man named Martin Del Rio, 32 years old, a veteran, works in Veterans Affairs, as a matter of fact, bright young guy who I think is just going to fit in really well, and that's something that's near and dear to my heart since I spent two terms on the Highland Town Council in my former life. I'm really pleased about Martin being involved. We have out in Crown Point, now I'm jumping around a little, a young man, Zach Bryant, 28 years old, born and raised in the community, Andrean grads, got an MBA, and he's the general manager of Crown Brewing, which is the family-owned, his family-owned business. Here in Schererville, for example, we have two new faces and relatively young faces, too. Vanessa Welty running in the 5th Council District and Robin Arvanitis running in, I think that's the 3rd District. Believe me, Chris, it hasn't been that difficult recruiting these folks. When you get out there and you let them know that you want, we always start out with the premise that this is for your community. Mm-hmm. This isn't necessarily, although we like it to be for the Democratic Party, but this is a way to give back to your community and to do for your community. And we knew people that have volunteered, people that were involved in their community, so we went out and recruited them, and fortunately have been very, very successful.
Are they finding that in most cases that these are people that are very well aware of the fact that they're going to have to work hard to go out there and campaign? Maybe there may be, luckily, in communities where there are Democratic majorities, but they may be in some places where there are still a lot of Republicans that are still in office, and they're going to have to go out there and convince people that they're willing to take the job and they're worthy of taking the job.
Well, that's a great point, Chris. We don't give them any false illusions. We don't go out there and tell them, that it's going to be a walk in the park. We let them know that it's challenging in any community, and particularly in those communities, for example, where Zach Bryan's running, where it's, I don't even think that Crown Point's ever had a majority Democratic council. I don't believe they have. So, and he's running at large. And he knows the challenges ahead. I spent not only myself, but others spent many hours talking to Zach about what it would take. And what I've always said, Chris, and I point this out to people that ask me often about Chris Chung. Well, how does a 26-year-old young man who's never been involved in government or politics, how does that happen? And it's always my premise that the first and foremost thing is you've got to have a committed candidate. You've got to have a candidate that I say has the fire burning in the belly. That's what you have to determine. It can't be something where someone says, geez, if you don't have anybody else, maybe I'll think about doing it or I might do it. No, that isn't what works. What works is somebody that says, I want to do this. I have a desire to do this. I have a plan to do this. This is what I think. That's what's needed, and those are the kind of people. Those are the kind of folks we've got running now, and that's why I feel so good about it, because they're in it for the right reasons. They're in it because they want to do it. They're in it because they want to serve their communities. They don't hold any illusions about that it's going to be a cakewalk or anything. They know, and they have been since the primary, all working very, very hard.
Are there any spots left on the ballot in any of the communities coming up here that will have to be filled before the deadline?
No, the deadline occurred.
Okay, so it has passed. So everybody's on the ballot that's going to be on the ballot, and I suppose it's time to get the ballots together and ready to go. When they are facing some formidable opponents in communities, as we say, the communities will say that have a number of Republicans on the ballot, or if they're just going out there and having to really, really work hard to become members of the council, or are there any opportunities that they're out there for people that maybe are just kind of thinking about whether they really want to run for office? They can kind of get experience in working as members of the polls or any place like that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Chris, we've set up a program, and I'm meeting with a number of the folks next Wednesday, Wednesday the 10th, kind of like an organizational meeting. And we've come up with an idea sort of put together by Chris Chung and myself, and along with the help of my precinct organization and our officers, to put together sort of an internship program. And we've got a number of young people that are seniors in high school, freshmen in college, young folks that want to work and get involved in government and in politics. So what we said is, well, here's another way you can do it. There's no precinct positions, or at least there's not a race for precinct positions now. So, but here's what you can do. Get involved in a campaign. get involved in helping out candidates and in helping out our organization. And so we've got a number of people we've recruited in that regard. We're going to have the meeting here at my office next Wednesday to get them started, and we're going to assign them throughout the county to help out certain candidates and certain campaigns that where we think that the Democrats have a very good chance of winning or preserving seats, particularly, for example, Crown Point, also in Lowell, where I think we have a really good chance of winning a majority of councilmen in Lowell. So in those areas where traditionally Democrats have had the Democratic Party has struggled a bit in the past, we don't think we're going to struggle anymore. We think that we relate to what people believe. We get people out there working, going door to door, and going to events and going to functions and letting them know who these candidates are and why they want to serve their community. So, yes, there's plenty of opportunity for other people to get involved.
What do some of the incumbents, their Democrats, think about these people that are coming up in the ranks and, as you say, becoming going to be, I guess, in a way, assistants, certainly to the candidates that are out there? What do the old-timers or the old hands seem to think about the idea of bringing a younger, more inexperienced but anxious and very, very willing people and want to become public office?
That's interesting. There's always that that dynamic there. And that sort of not necessarily conflict, but there is that kind of push and shove there between those that have been in office or those that have been in politics for quite some time and those that haven't. But I mean, look at myself, Chris. I'm not a spring chicken here. I've done this a long time. I'm absolutely convinced that more than ever, there's a in the Democratic Party as a whole, nationally and statewide, we have a generation gap. And those of us of the generation that for a long time were at the top of the heap and were controlling things just need to recognize that it's a new day. And I don't mean necessarily a wholesale change, because there's a whole lot to be said for institutional knowledge and experience. Don't get me wrong. We've got great, I think, you know, right now, people bridging the generational gaps who are good public officials, take our sheriff, Oscar Martinez, or take our county commissioner, Mike Repay. I mean, folks like that who are not on the super young side, but yet bridge that gap and have shown and demonstrate to these younger folks how people can serve the community and can serve Northwest Indiana. But what we've done is I think we've kind of eased into it a little bit, and we've had a lot of discussion about it and a lot of meetings over it. And those old-timers, as you say, understand that there's a new generation coming along, and as long as we get good, qualified young people and they see that these folks are there for the right reasons and the right intentions and have a lot of energy to offer, they know that it, in the long run, it helps all of us. So it hasn't been as difficult to start working on that change as, quite frankly, I thought it was going to be.
That's good news. That's good news. We'll look forward to seeing these new candidates out on the campaign trail in the communities around Lake County, looking for votes, looking for supporters. And we appreciate you sitting down and talking over some of this information with them, as well as offering this information to us to give us some insight as to what these new candidates are really like and how interested they really seem to be in wanting to become public office. And we hope to we'll see what happens, of course, in the November election. But we hope that many succeed.
Well, thank you, Chris. It was great talking to you, and happy to do it anytime.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Weiser is Lake County Democratic Party Chairman. You're listening to Regionally Speaking.
Remember those financial resolutions we made here after the 1st of January? Well, it's now halfway through the year. Since we have June in full swing, we're getting to the midway point of the year, and maybe time to see if those financial goals seem to be matching up with your current lifestyle. Well, for that, let's turn to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer for a little review and take out that checklist and see how things are looking there. Greg, thanks. thanks for being with us. And let's jump right in. What are some of the 5 points we need to take a look at here at the middle of the year?
Well, I think the first place to start for most people is, check your retirement contributions. I always tell people, first and foremost, you should at least be taking advantage of any type of employer match that might be available to you. I always tell people it's free money. You don't want to leave that on the table at all. But ideally, hopefully, you aim for maxing out your tax-favored retirement plans that not only might include the 401k, but, different contributions to, say, like a Roth or maybe some college plans, things that you need to do to help build your future and your nest egg and take care of some of the financial hurdles that you have.
Mm-hmm. How about the question about debt? We all need to look at that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, debt's always one of those evils, right? It's out there. Most people battle it to some degree. I think today in the modern era of credit cards, it's easy to kind of fall into the trap because it's easy access to that availability of funds. But with the rising interest rate, and it has kind of stalled a little bit with the interest rates, but they're still historically low. So taking advantage to pay down some of those balances before those rates start to climb. If you don't, it could absolutely cripple your budget because, as interest rates rise, the minimum payments become higher, and it's harder and harder to tackle some of that debt.
Mm-hmm. I know that we always advise people that they should, and we hear from other advisors too, about making sure that you've got between 3 and 6 months' worth of living expenses backed up there on that rainy day fund. But I understand that may not be enough. You should have more. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I think that this is probably one of the easiest things to overlook as an individual, as a family. When things happen unexpectedly, that's generally what spirals financial disaster. Usually if we don't have that type of money, something happens, it's not just being laid off of work or having a job change. It's, the car breaks down, the roof leaks, things that come up in everyday life that are those unexpected expenses. And if you don't have money put aside, then you end up using the credit cards. And also, if you do end up in a situation where, income changes or, we have a job change, whatever it might be, without that reserve, it's hard to build a strategy to recover from, sudden life change.
Mm-hmm. I know, too, that to keep an eye on your spending as much as you possibly can, but I guess there are sometimes that maybe we panic a bit more because things aren't changing like they should. How should we be able to keep better track of our spending?
Well, I think the first thing is, in monitoring your spending is kind of look at where your debt level was 6 months ago when you looked at it in January and see where it's going. Are you gaining? Are you breaking even kind of? Is it getting worse? And, when you begin to look at it from a high level, then it's time to sit down and look at your actual budget. I always have told people a good exercise. I'm not a big budget fan, but it is a good exercise to create a budget to kind of see where your expenses are going. And I think even more so, Chris, just write down everywhere you spend money mm-hmm. in a notebook for 30 to 60 days and really try to identify where the money is going. And if at the end of the day, I always tell people it's about two things, what's coming in and what's going out. If what's going out is more than what's coming in, you have to make some hard decisions, about what you're doing currently and what you're spending money on, and it might require some lifestyle changes. Either that or you might seriously consider, hey, the career I'm in, maybe I need to look at a different type of career or look at creating additional income. But that's really the A and B of the equation that you just need to get a grip on.
Yeah, I know that a lot of people have had an opportunity here, especially in keeping track of their expenses, and you say some of their lifestyle moves. Maybe some people have had to make changes. Not to say that the cable people like to hear about this, but people have cut the cable, literally. They've gone to other services to get their entertainment rather than cable television because it's gotten so expensive for them. And I know that's one way that you can keep track of your finances, too. And we don't always talk about taxes, except it seems like around income tax filing time, but it might not be a bad idea to review them here by the end of the year.
Yeah, well, and you've heard me say this before. I think there's two things when it comes to just taxes in general. If you come in to get your taxes done and during tax season, it's all about preparation. There can be no planning. We can't undo what was done in the previous year. It's more about, let's put the input in and see how it turned out. So preparation is one thing, but planning, I think, is paramount when it comes to getting a handle on your taxes and understanding what the liability is before you go to file your taxes and trying to, you know, have an accurate target or an idea of what that liability might be. And then second, I think, you know, what's really kind of unique in the situation we are with the tax law change, I believe this is one of the best tax planning opportunities that people could potentially have and since I've been in the business. Because, you know, previously, especially with two working families, you know, there was not a lot of room to work within the tax brackets. And now with the new laws in place, there's opportunity to consider things like Roth conversion that simply did not exist before this tax law change. And, you know, having an understanding of those tax laws and having your advisor work in connection with your tax advisor could provide some great opportunities to create tax efficiencies, tax savings, you know, just tax planning opportunities.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer, and we know that you've been in your business, no doubt you talk to a lot of millennials, a lot of Gen Xers and all, and probably they get a chance to take a look at how their finances are doing and seeing how they can compare themselves with their father's generation. And sometimes a father doesn't always know best, does he?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we get both examples when it comes to our parents, our fathers, our mothers. You know, you get the example on the side, hey, this is a good role model. You get the example, maybe this is not the way, you know, I want to see my retirement unfold. And, you know, it's both sides of the equation for different people. But just understanding spending, you know, one of the things my father was always very, very diligent on, he goes, you know, he never even owned a credit card. He always wanted to pay cash, always wanted to pay in time, was just phenomenal in not getting into debt. But, you know, it's a good example, it's a good principle to teach. Whether your father was good at it or not, it's still a principle that's taught. And devising a plan around understanding that example can help avoid either the trap or, you know, follow down the same path that was very effective for your father.
Do you think, too, that maybe for older Americans, they've seen, looking back at their fathers who may or may not properly plan for retirement, that maybe that they were kind of headed down the wrong road, and so you're hoping that your youngsters or your grandkids don't follow suit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, realistically, most families today, I think, are very much paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, as you have opportunities to maybe change that situation, maybe there's an increase in income or a bonus, a raise, whatever it might be, a job change, you know, often we find ourselves with that lifestyle creep. You know, we have a situation where, you know, the discretionary income rises and we find a way to put it in part of our budget and spend the money. And while that deservedly so, you should do some of that, I think it's very significant and important to at least take some portion of that and, you know, either go towards debt reduction or go towards savings. I always tell people, pay yourself first. You know, pay yourself first and then improve that situation long term while still enjoying it in the moment.
Well, Greg, it's always great to hear some advice here and to think back about how things have happened in the past and what not to do in the future. And we are glad we have an opportunity to chat with you to get some of this upcoming advice. Certainly for listeners that may in turn have questions, they can, of course, always check in with their own financial advisor. But it's nice to give us get the overall view from the big picture. Thanks for being with us, Greg, and I hope to have you back on again soon.
Thanks, Chris.
We've been talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is a legend in Northwest Indiana theater, Angie Lowe, who for decades was the director of the Lake Central Theater Guild.
Yes, together with my husband.
Yes, and now the director of L'Arc-en-Ciel.
Excellent. You pronounce it prononcé parfaitement.
You know, I can pronounce languages, I just can't speak.
Right. Well, and L'Arc-en-Ciel in French means the arch in sky, in other words, rainbow. So we're looking for our pot of gold. We'll never find it because we like to say, we're sad to say, that we put the knot into the not-for-profit.
That's very clever.
That's what we do.
That's wonderful.
And we were at Lake Central for 38 years. We actually stayed on for 4 and 3 years, respectively, after we retired at the behest of our then superintendent. Mm. And then things happen.
Yes.
So we left there December of 04 and started our first show in January of 05 at Great Oaks Banquet Center, mm-hmm. in what used to be the swimming pool.
Oh.
A place where I swam in the 60s and 70s. Do not try to picture me in a bathing suit.
But now it's where you do theater.
Our theater, and it's a dinner theater.
It's a dinner theater, yeah. And you do shows throughout the year.
Yes, 3 or 4, maybe 5 shows a year.
Yeah. So this summer, coming up in July now,
yes.
You have Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Yes, we do, and it's our 5th or 6th version of it, having started in 1983, again in 91, somewhere in the 2000s, and mm-hmm. then in 9 years ago we did it, and we're doing it again.
What makes you choose it so frequently?
Well, it's a loved show, and it's great with kids, little ones, as well as teens and adults, and it's got something for everybody. Because we are L'Arc-en-Ciel Rainbow, it's a rainbow of colors.
That's true.
Golden, red and golden. Oh, my gosh. I don't even know all the colors in order.
Roy G. Biv.
Well, I know that's the rainbow, but the colors that are listed on Joseph's coat, there are like several dozen of those. But and it's just a happy, uppy show, and we do some little quirky things with it. Made some camel costumes. So some people are in a camel costume to come in when the Ishmaelites sell Joseph to Potiphar. Little silly things that we have little sheep.
It's a large cast, I take it.
29, 30, 30. Uh-huh. We haven't counted.
Because you have to cast all those camels and sheep.
Well, two per camel, one per sheep. But those kids are doubling. Yeah, we have 11 extra brothers besides Joseph.
Yeah.
We have one little gender-bending girl who's playing a brother.
Oh, how fun. Because
we were a little bit low on fewer guys uh-huh. than we needed, but that's okay. And she's having a lot of fun. Ironically, her name is Sam. So that all works. Plays Dan. And we have father-son combinations, mother-daughter combination, and just a lot of great, eager, new, cooperative, fun, clean kids.
That's great.
By golly.
What wonderful opportunities you're giving them.
We try.
And yeah.
After 38 years in education, that's what we're all about.
So so it's a dinner theater.
Yes.
So people buy a ticket and they get dinner as well as the show.
Yes, they go upstairs for the dinner portion, and that is all those monies go to Tom McAdams, our very generous host, mm-hmm. who said back in 04, late 04, let's try it, see if mm-hmm. it'll work.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been doing it ever since, just a gentleman's agreement, handshake, no contract. The man does not charge us rent.
That's amazing.
John, we couldn't do it. We're already in the red with credit card payments for the theater, and he doesn't charge us utilities, and he allows us to do the theater in the what was the swimming pool.
Uh-huh.
Luckily, they had two little tiny little dressing rooms.
Uh-huh.
Everybody goes upstairs for dinner. That's their dinner venue, and although there's a stairway, mm-hmm. there's a parking around the back with a handicap parking available in the back. Then people come down and have the show. That's what we do.
So you worked with your husband?
Yes. Oh, yes.
For how many years?
Well, we've been, Paul and I, when people say, how long have you been married? We look at each other. Then we say to them, happily. And then after they chuckle, then we look at each other again, and each of us purposely says a different number, and then we look again and change the number, and it's still different. Then we say something like 42, 47, not bad out of 55. It'll be 55 years on Friday, August 2, when we have a performance, if we haven't killed each other by then.
Uh-huh. Well, you two have a shtick, don't you?
We have a kind of a shtick.
You should have been. Were you in vaudeville?
No, but I'm old enough.
No, you're not.
No, but Paul and I never had any plans to do theater, and that's not on our questions. It was fine print in his first teaching contract
uh-huh.
that said you will direct 2 shows. I came along the next semester. Who else is going to help him? Boom. We fell in love with it. We are audience members, so that's how we direct.
Yeah. Well, Angie, I knew it would be an easy interview.
Yeah.
And it was. And thank you. And I wish you great luck with Joseph this summer. And thank you all for listening. And we'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the
Thank
Arts.
You, John.
If you missed any portion of this conversation, you can catch it later online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. And we'll be back with you tomorrow.